The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week with my roster of fund managers, analysts, and journalists, both on the ground in frontier and emerging markets and also in major financial centers, we examine these markets, try to clear up some of the misconceptions about them and make it clear that they're an attractive asset class, and also suggest courses of action for you, the listener. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and the not-so-promising ones. By emerging markets, of course, we mean the BRIC markets, which are the major economies, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, along with Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. And today we'll have a report on the continuing Russia-Ukraine crisis, which we've been featuring quite a lot in the last few weeks, understandably. By frontier markets, we mean those less developed economies in general, countries like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, and Botswana, and also some of the wealthy states based in the Gulf, such as Qatar, the UAE, and Kuwait. And today we'll be looking at what's been happening in the Gulf, but also several areas of Africa, including Nigeria, which, of course, as you know, there's been a great deal of coverage with Boko Haram. And so the situation where they have taken over 200 girls hostages and are holding them in exchange for the government actually coming back to them and giving concessions. So we'll have some follow-up on that. But in the meantime, we wanted to start off by looking at some of the major emerging markets and seeing how they're doing so far. So for that reason, we wanted to have a word with one of our regular contributors, Paul DeSisto, who's senior portfolio manager at M&R Capital in New York, where he helps manage over $500 million in assets under management. So, Paul, I just wanted to check that you're there on the line.
Yes, sir, I am.
Excellent. Really good to have you here. Two of the stories that might give investors pause about investing in emerging markets are the Russia-Ukraine crisis, which I mentioned, and also the prospects for a hard landing in China. Today, you're going to have a look at both of them for us. So if I were to start off by saying that if I'm an emerging markets investor, I might be wanting to maybe be a little cautious about investing in both Russia and China, two of the BRIC markets, would that be a fair statement?
I think it would be fair, unless, of course, one is a contrarian. And I think it's kind of interesting to mention that a very well-known investor, far more well-known than me, named Jim Rogers, is investing heavily in Russia right now because he sees it as a very good value, given that it has sold off so much. He's also investing in China, and he wants to look at India, though he's concerned about the current account deficit. So if one is a contrarian investor, there is opportunity in Russia and China. However, as you may have alluded to earlier, there's a situation in those countries with the hard landing, particularly with the shadow banking in China, the ongoing Ukraine crisis. It may be a long time before these things turn around. So there are plenty of other countries out there that I think are good alternatives to China and Russia if one wants to sleep a little bit better at night.
So for those looking for other alternatives, what would you suggest that emerging market investors or investors thinking about emerging markets might want to look at as opposed to those two markets which do have major issues?
I think India, which has been actually pretty strong this year, it's up 8.6% year-to-date in local currency, 11% in dollar terms, is looking quite good. There is a Morgan Stanley India ETF, which is, of course, very well subscribed to. It's actually up 23%. But even though it's up that much, it's barely half its last most recent peak in 2010, and that's when the emerging market slowdown began. It was three times higher than that, even before the financial crisis, 2008. So, of course, there's always the issue with their current account deficit in India. But as I said in my last appearance several weeks ago, these deficits should not be a problem if foreign investors are willing to provide capital, which they seem to be. And I think a lot of the reason the stock market there has been strong is because of the outlook for a more market-friendly government, the Bharatiya Janata Party, and a fellow named Narendra Modi. So if he continues to look like he's in the winning column there, this should continue. There's another fund there, too, if one wants to get something that hasn't gone up quite so much. There's the Emerging Global Markets India Small Cap Fund. The symbol is SCIN. It's actually a small to mid-cap weighted blended fund with both growth and value stocks. The trailing PE is 11.2. And the asset class of small cap emerging market funds is 16.84. So in that regard, it's a pretty good value. It is trading at a 3% premium to NAV because it has run up sharply over the last couple of weeks. So it might best be purchased on a day that it backs off a bit.
So that's India, Paul. But I think your next choice might actually be surprising to one or two people, especially given I was starting in the introduction talking about the situation with Boko Haram. I think you feel that Nigeria might be worth looking at.
I do, in fact, Gavin. The one ETF there, the Global X Nigeria ETF, has a PE of less than 9. And as I mentioned, it's over 16 for the emerging market small asset class. With many of these very small frontier markets, energy and financials do make up two-thirds of the assets, so that's something to keep in mind. But that's a double-edged sword like so many other things. It actually plays a pretty decent distribution, most of its dividend, 1.2%. So there are some opportunities here if one is willing to overlook the news regarding the girls that you already mentioned earlier. So it's not for the faint of heart, but I think there's a lot of opportunity in Nigeria.
And a couple of other ones that might be maybe a little more mainstream in the emerging markets that you think are worth considering?
I think Brazil is looking good. There's continued an increase in displeasure with the incumbent president, Dilma Rousseff, who seems to not have quite the expected pro-market bent that people were hoping for when she was first elected. It looks like the centrist Aseio Neves will probably get elected president later this year. One of the problems here, of course, is the state oil company, Petrobras, is still required by the state to sell gasoline below cost. This is not good, and there's hope that this will end. And when you have a company like Petrobras, which is the largest company in a large economy like Brazil, and it starts to do well, it tends to drag everything else up with it. There are some funds there that look very, very good, particularly on a technical basis. There's the iShares Brazil Small Cap Fund. The symbol is EWZF. There's the Global X Brazil Mid Cap ETF, symbol BRAZ. And the Index Brazil Infrastructure Index Funds, BRXX. This last one in particular is kind of interesting because one of Brazil's problems is lack of infrastructure, and that's why they've been having so many riots because people don't think that they're getting the services. So there is a lot of opportunity there. And I would also mention that all of these funds that I've mentioned have PEs less than the U.S. market right now, which is 18.05. Most of these price-to-earnings ratios of these funds I mentioned are in the very high single-digit or very low double-digit range.
Now, that's obviously an important point, because if you're at, the price you pay tends to dictate the returns that you make, regardless of how good the underlying growth is. And if you're paying a relatively reasonable price, as you are with a single digit PE. Fairly briefly, there's a couple of Asian markets that you do like, I think, in Southeast Asia.
I like Indonesia. Indonesia is the fourth most populous country in the world, with 245 million folks living there. And it's the largest market in Southeast Asia after China. There were two funds below that are both looking good, and I like the fact that they both have a yield of around 2 to 3%. Market Vectors Indonesia, symbol IGX, and iShares MSCI India ETF, symbol EIDO.
Sounds a bit like old McDonald, doesn't it? It's EIDO.
Right. So they're looking pretty good, also on a P/E ratio and so forth. And the final country that I have, that I've my model, my screen has come up with, is iShares MSCI Philippines, symbol is EPHE. This fund has had a bit of a run over the past few weeks, and it's the only fund of all the ones that I've mentioned that has a PE close to the S&P. It's at 18 versus 16.84 for its assets class as well for the emerging markets. But the price to cash flow I found here is 6 versus a 9.3 average, and it does yield almost 1%. So when I get paid with a dividend, I tend to feel a little bit more comfortable. And most of these funds, or all of these funds that I've mentioned, do pay a dividend.
Now, that's certainly an important point, and it's something we've mentioned in our newsletter, the importance of looking for not merely growth in emerging and frontier markets, but actually growth with income. So just to finish up here, Paul, I think we start off by saying that Russia and China didn't look particularly attractive. But for those who have the stomach for Russia, the well-known investment guru, Jim Rogers, whom you mentioned, did have a bit of Jim Rogers type advice, which tends to be a little bit like Baron Rothschild, buy when, to the sound of cannon. What was he saying about Russia?
He likes the way the large oil company, energy company, Gazprom is looking. So that's very, very attractive to him. I did a little bit of research on the Russia small cap ETF, by the way, symbol RXKJ. Yep. It actually has a PE of 7 and a price to book of 0.52. Very, very cheap. It's come down a lot from its, just where it was 3 months ago, right after the Olympics, when everything was looking really well. The stock has started to turn around, this ETF, and I think this is an opportunity if one wants to get into Russia, get a little bit more growth with the smaller cap Russian names.
Well, that certainly would be a brave man who is stepping in now. But then on the other hand, that's how people like Jim Rogers came to make their fortunes, by being willing to go against the crowd. So thanks very much, Paul. That's been a very interesting survey of what does look attractive in the emerging market space. And you make excellent points about the cheapness and the yield. We'll be back talking to you again soon, I'm sure.
Thanks very much, Gavin. Bye-bye.
Bye. And thanks to Paul DeSisto at M&R Capital in New York for that look at some emerging market choices for those who might want to steer clear of Russia and, to a lesser extent, China. Just before we go to the break, when we're talking about Middle East and African markets, it's usually focusing on such major countries in the Gulf as the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, or perhaps Nigeria. But Morocco is actually one of the larger components of that region, having been downgraded from emerging market to frontier market status in November. It's come a long way since Humphrey Bogart told Sam to play it again. What's happening now? How did it lose its emerging market status? And can it regain that emerging market status? If you subscribe to our new publication, the FMI newsletter, please go to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. You'll find an article on Morocco and some of the factors that make it quite an interesting choice. When we come back, we'll be talking about what's happening in Russia with our regular correspondent, James Beadle. Thanks so much.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Just before we go to our next guest to talk about Russia, one of the other BRIC countries, China, its economy is definitely slowing down. You'll see lots of contradictory views as to whether or not this is a soft landing or maybe a more serious slowdown. In the FMI newsletter, we actually try to address some of the confusion about China. It's quite difficult because the official statistics aren't actually all that reliable. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. So back to Russia. It's been a regular feature on this program over the last few weeks because we've had continuing developments. It looks like, first of all, Russia might be going deeper into recession. We were talking about the downgrade by some of the rating agencies last week. Meanwhile, Reuters has reported this morning that Russia's attempt to blunt the effect of sanctions from the West included a demand that exporters such as resource companies be paid in rubles, not American dollars. Because of the sanctions, American banks are prohibited from processing transactions for at least 18 major Russian companies, including a lot of the export import companies. To sort out the confusing political situation with the ongoing problems in Ukraine, as well as what this means for Russian equities, we have our Russian analyst James Beadle on the line from Monaco. Welcome back, James.
Thanks very much, Gavin. Great to be here.
Indeed. So can you bring us up to date on the fallout from the two so-called illegitimate referenda or improper referenda held in eastern Ukraine by the pro-Russian separatists this weekend? There's supposedly a 9-1 vote in favor of secession from Ukraine. On the other hand, both the West and the Ukrainian provisional government are saying that these are illegitimate and it should be disregarded. What exactly is happening there?
Well, yeah, as you say, the referendum took place. It was actually quite surprising that they took place because right after our last call last Wednesday, there was some rather surprising statements by Vladimir Putin who suggested that the referendum ought to be postponed. Excuse me. And also that maybe he would put some more emphasis and credibility behind the elections planned for the 25th of May. So it was a bit of a surprise that the referendum actually went ahead somewhat against his public suggestion, but go ahead they did as best they could. I have little doubt that the voting that was polled was fairly accurate. I'm sure a very strong percentage of people who voted in favor of the pro-Russians. However, the question would be whether or not a full majority of the population voted. I think most people stayed away from them. And for this reason, if no other, it seems unlikely that they will be given much credibility, at least by the West.
Okay, so if therefore we're now coming up to less than 2 weeks away before the Ukrainian election. There's been a roundtable of Ukrainian politicians and civil groups, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation for Europe is scheduled to be meeting, I think it's today, to try to prepare a roadmap for a peaceful resolution of the crisis. What's the best that we can expect from this?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of a number of steps that's been going on in the last week or so. And I think the big picture of what we see at the moment is really a sort of ratcheting down of the level of tension, violence and nervousness around the whole subject. And I think slowly things are beginning to move towards a slightly more pragmatic basis. And so these discussions, which at least ostensibly have the support of the Russian government, are clearly a positive sign. I'm not sure if the pro-Russian groups are attending them. I think there might not be. But this doesn't mean that they can't lead to some clear results. I think if the Ukrainian side can continue to demonstrate a willingness to address the genuine problems of the pro-Russian groups, perhaps then we'll be able to get everyone at the table and move towards a sort of resolution a bit more.
I mean, that's a fairly sort of hopeful outlook, and obviously most people, I think, would be hoping that something like that could happen. But does the fact that the referendum went ahead in the eastern Ukrainian regions after Vladimir Putin has said he didn't think they ought to indicate some loss of control by him? Or is it merely that he's sort of having a two-track policy and keeping up the pressure through allowing the referendum to go ahead while at the same time engaging in discussions to come to a peaceful resolution?
Yeah, well, I mean, as I'm sure you're very well aware, hope is definitely not a strategy, and so we definitely need to do more than hope. As far as Mr. Putin's influence is there, it certainly is very, very strong, but it's not very strong all the time and every day. I think if he decided to switch off the funding and support for the pro-Russian groups, their behavior would change very quickly. So you're right, in a sense, it does look as if he's playing both sides of the fence a little bit to try and move towards a resolution without giving up too much ground. But on the same time, once he's made a public statement of this kind of clarity and levity, it's rather difficult for him to back down on it. And so I think it's a relatively clear indication of where he wants to get to ultimately.
So assuming that, therefore, the elections are held in a relatively peaceful fashion on May 25th and are acknowledged to be legitimate by both all sides, how much of that potentially successful outcome has been baked into the performance of Russian equities and bonds? I mean, the MICEX was edging up yesterday, but it's still down more than 10% year to date, and obviously a lot more in US dollar or euro terms, given the weakness of the ruble. Should we expect to see that recovery continue, and if there is a successful resolution coming out of the elections, we might actually see quite a sharp rebound, as indeed you were looking for when the crisis first started, feeling that most of the bad news was reflected?
Yeah, I mean, even in the last week, I think we must have seen a good sort of 5 to 8% return on the indexes as the tension has ratcheted down. So in many share prices and many indexes, we're moving well back towards where we sort of started the worst parts of the crisis, which is good progress already. Looking forward, it is a lot more complicated because obviously people are going to be a lot more careful about investing in long-term projects in Russia over the next sort of year or two, unless we see a big shift in activity and rhetoric from the Russian government. So, I mean, I would caution against just piling into the ETFs as has been done in the past. But at the same time, if you're right, if we do see an election which gets the approval of the Russian authorities as well as the Ukrainians, it still seems as we're not quite there yet. But if we did get that, then we would see a healthy bounce in the markets. And I think a well-managed fund would be able to pick the names which were best positioned to benefit from it.
Indeed, and obviously if I know that in the past we've discussed maybe investors ought to be looking at hard currency earning exporters rather than more domestically oriented stocks, as we were initially talking about. But what would be a reasonable timescale, assuming, again, and as you say, hope's not a policy, but assuming that from the tenor of the discussions that are going on at present, we have a successful Ukrainian election that's accepted by all sides. We've seen some strength in the market. Would on an 18-month to two-year view, would that be a reasonable time frame for investors who have some exposure to Russia or are thinking about it to look at going forward?
Normally, yes. I certainly have never recommended anybody to buy equities with less than a sort of 1 to 2 year horizon anyway. That said, I would expect to see the bounce quicker than that. Either I think people want to take a dose of courage and charge in now-ish, or hold back and let the market settle after the elections and then come in with a longer term horizon.
So starting to look at the possible outcomes here. Do you feel that the sanctions on exporters and the sort of switch to rubles, evidently that would indicate that the sanctions are having some effect. is maybe the Russian authorities putting a brave face on things. I mean, as we've discussed in the past, Russia has over $400 billion in foreign exchange reserves. Nonetheless, at the rate that capital seems to be going out of Russia, that could be eaten into fairly rapidly. Are the sanctions having some effect?
I don't think the sanctions actually in place are having too much effect. I think what's having more effect is the threat of more serious sanctions. And really, when I look at the global markets, I see the global markets really believe that the threat of sanctions is going to have an impact, because clearly Russia's down, but given the scale of the potential of another Cold War, US markets and other markets are doing very well. So in general, I think people are confident in the ability of Western governments and economic sanctions to have an impact. And yes, definitely the shift in ruble policy is closely related to the idea that they need to get away from U.S. funding, as all U.S. transactions potentially get monitored by the Treasury. But if somebody's, for example, working in euros and buying rubles from that, then maybe they can sidestep the sanctions to some extent, if that's something that they're willing and interested to do.
Now, I know there's been moves on the part of a number of emerging markets to try to move away from a dollar-based economy, especially for commodities. Is Russia's attempts to move towards rubles, obviously there's a specific reason because of the sanctions, but do you feel this might lead to some erosion of the dollar's position longer term as the currency in which most trade gets conducted, simply because of, as we've seen with this crisis, the ability of the US government to actually impose sanctions on people using dollars?
Yeah, it's a very good point, and you're very right about it. Russia has been one of the leaders in the campaign to move away from the dollar's global reserve status for some time. And so, in a sense, the idea that they want to work more in rubles is not new at all. And if you look at their natural sphere of influence around the former Soviet Union, there is certainly a legitimate case to argue for it. Whether it works or not, I think, will depend more on sort of the role Russia wants to take in the global economy. And if they continue to go down an isolationist path, then definitely not. But if they come back to the sort of global table, then they have every chance to become a significant global hub currency, even if things continue to improve.
Excellent. Thanks very much indeed, James. There's some excellent and useful information there. As always, the situation is so fluid. It changes week by week, day by day. I'm sure we'll be back talking to you again, especially with the Ukrainian elections up in less than 2 weeks. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Have a great show.
And you too. Just before we go to the break and talk to our next guest, I was discussing with Paul De Sisto at the top of the program the importance of dividends as a major factor looking at markets you might want to invest in. And Paul was mentioning the number of the ETFs he was looking at for countries such as Indonesia, the Philippines, Nigeria actually had yields of 1-2%. So it's not merely growth that one should look at when considering investing in emerging frontier markets. Dividends and dividend growth are an important aspect. And in the new edition of the EFMI newsletter, we take a detailed look at dividends and emerging market equities and suggest a possible way of playing that. To find out more about this, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. Or you can buy EFMI immediately at our discounted price of $94.99 by going to www.emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter/buy. When I come back, we'll be looking at the effect of China's slowdown on some of the markets in the Middle East and the United Arab Emirates. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you. Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on Frontier Markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
Game-changing technologies and strategies are transformational, exciting, and disruptive for a reason. They shake up your status quo. They get you thinking about new ways to scale, compete, and grow. They move you in amazing new directions. You're invited to Take Your Coffee Break with Game Changers on Thursdays at 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time for our special series on the future of business. Learn how you can become the transformational leader who takes your company across the finish line as you look ahead to the next breakthrough wave of innovation. The Future of Business with Game Changers, presented by SAP on the Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. As I was saying just before the break, China is obviously a major factor in global markets and in other emerging and frontier markets as well. I have journalist editor Mark Townsend online, who's a regular contributor to this program and to our first book, Investing in Frontier Markets, which came out towards the end of last year. Now, he's based in Dubai, which is in the United Arab Emirates, and they, along with Qatar, are being moved up from frontier market status to emerging market status this month. Meanwhile, China, one of the major trading partners of the Gulf states, is slowing down, although it's not quite as bad as might have been feared. Nonetheless, in the first quarter of 2014, China's economy only grew by an annualized rate of 7.4%, down from 7.7% during the final quarter of 2013. At a recent IHS conference in Dubai, the implications of a hard landing in China for the region were discussed. So, Mark, welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing.
It's good to be with you, Gavin. Thank you.
Thanks. You attended most of the IHS conference on the impact of a slowdown. How serious was the prospect of a hard landing for China felt to be in terms of the different papers presented?
Well, as you said earlier, Gavin, there's a lot of speculation whether China's going to slow down or it will continue apace. But IHS have actually come out with a report and saying that there's a 1 in 3 chance in the next 3 years that there'll be what they define as a hard landing. And they pinpoint that commodity and equipment exports to China are particularly vulnerable to that slowdown should China's asset bubbles burst. And let's face it, you know, China's got a lot of bubbles around at the moment. So IHS developed the scenario because, you know, the greater prospects, I think, and there's no question the prospects have increased of China's GDP growth slowing substantially if any one of these bubbles were to finally burst. So that would bring about a scenario of severe tightening of credit conditions, they said, and following the crash of the housing market, for example, and default presumably by a significant number of the major real estate developers there. And it would also bring about a drop in confidence of obviously domestic and international investors would, you know, take it very seriously and would be very scared by it. You know, it has global ramifications. So that you know, the consequence of that is cutbacks in fixed investment, consumption, a slowing of exports and goods and services, and obviously significant erosion in domestic demand, causing China to experience, you know, its first sort of period of deflation. So rather than holding near the 7.5% as expected, China's real GDP growth is probably going to decline under this scenario to 6.6% this year, and as low as 4.8% in 2015 before gradually reviving. So these are quite heady numbers, Gavin.
They are indeed. I was just actually, that intake of breath you heard was me hearing a 4.8% number for 2015. I think perhaps because one of the problems is that a number of people feel social stability in China might be at risk if nominal GDP growth slows down much below 5%, given the stresses of a rapidly emerging economy. Specifically in terms of the Middle East, if this hard landing scenario, which, as you said, IHS gives maybe a 1 in 3 possibility of emerging, what would that do to the Middle East in particular and the United Arab Emirates specifically?
Well, the IHS chief economist, Nariman Berevesh, outlined it in quite a lot of detail, and he said that the China hard landing would mean the Middle East would experience weaker exports, lower tourism and business activity, and probably a resurgence of risk aversion by global companies due to new deterioration in the global economic paradigm, just at the moment when they thought it was safe to get back into the water. So in a weaker growth scenario that IHS outlined, if China slowed to, say, 3 to 4%, then oil prices could decline to around about $50 to $60 a barrel, which is extremely significant, Gavin, because what we're seeing now in places like Saudi Arabia, Oman, Bahrain, their break-even price for oil production is creeping up all the time. I memory serves me right, it's sort of $80, $90+, depending on the country that you're looking at. So that immediately, potentially swings them into deficit. They're already, as a result of the Arab Spring, if you like, are throwing large amounts of money to sort of placate discontent, social spending, and so on and so forth. So all of a sudden, despite their massive reserves, they're for the first time in a long, long time, they potentially could be in a deficit position. So, a hard landing in China would mean real GDP would be slower in the Middle East in the short term. But IHS is not saying that they expect the slowdown to have major long-term consequences on growth in the Middle East. But the growth slowdown would be a few decimal points, with real GDP in Saudi Arabia declining probably only 1% in 2018, for example. But from my own personal perspective, having sort of monitored these markets, reported on these markets for quite some years, that I'm kind of worried by the break-even scenario if they were to if oil prices were to sort of decline to those kind of levels. It's suddenly not only have you got a scenario where there may be social discontent in China, I wonder what all the tectonic plates that are shifting in the geopolitical scene in this part of the world, what the consequences would be there as well.
So absolutely.
I think although China hard landing would have implications on oil prices and exports to China, the implications on growth in other countries and regions, particularly in Europe, are significant too, I think. Lower growth globally means weaker energy demand. China slowdown would have consequences on the future choices of financial investors. I mean, that's very clear. And, obviously tighter monetary conditions would follow in several emerging markets such as Turkey, which have close connections to the Middle East, Gavin.
Absolutely. No, that's an interesting and slightly worrying scenario that IHS is sketching out. And I think your personal experience of what the after effects could be is an important point for investors to bear in mind. Thanks very much indeed, Mark. I'm sure we'll be talking about possible effects of Chinese slowdown again with you in the not too distant future.
Thank you, Gavin.
Thanks so much. Now, switching from one side of the Middle East and Africa to the other, I have Malik Badji on the line from London. He's head of investment solutions at Silk Invest Funds there. And on June the 1st, Silk Invest and Bremer Asset Management will be launching their Emerging Africa bond fund. And we're going to have a look at it now. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Malik.
Hi, thank you, Gavin. Really appreciate it having you on.
Thank not at all. Before we actually look at the fund, why are you launching an African, I presume it's sovereign Africa bond fund right now?
Yeah, absolutely as well. I mean, we fundamentally believe it's really the last attractive frontier opportunity really in the fixed income space as well. As you're very well aware, since following the crisis of 2008 and 2009, the need for diversification in the fixed income world has become really a global phenomenon more than anything else. And what you've seen, particularly across the past 5 years, is significant migration and aggressive search for yield across all fixed income classes as well. And there's been a bit up in terms of value. What has been largely relatively unnoticed compared to the rest of the market has been the Africa fixed income market, where we feel it has provided the most attractive diversification across the board.
So presumably, one thing that's happened is that investors have become much more convinced that African countries are creditworthy. Therefore, their ability to actually raise money in the debt markets has expanded, and there's a lot bigger universe for you to look at to be able to launch this fund.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the three issues that you've always had with Africa, particularly, and I think it's a general trend across the frontier market, just as was the case with emerging market debt in the 1990s, is the issue of liquidity, the issue of volatility, and also the issue of a geopolitical concern as well. From the liquidity perspective as well, the total amount of issuance in Africa has increased rapidly over the past 5 years. You've looked at around 60 to 90 billion of new issuance coming into the market every year. So the total issuance on the local currency side is close to 400 billion, which is a tremendous opportunity as well. And the volatility levels as well, comparatively, have actually gone significantly lower as well. And what has made Africa local currencies especially attractive are not only the high yields, but also the fact that the interest rates have commonly exceeded inflation rates as well. So we think from an opportunity perspective, it's always been very compelling. But with the liquidity and the volatility having come down, we fundamentally believe makes it more attractive from an institutional perspective.
Indeed. So what are the credit ratings on some of the major issuers here in Africa? And secondly, as you said, you've had both the interest rates and volatility coming down. Presumably that's a reflection of an improved economic performance by these countries, lower inflation rates and things like that.
No, absolutely it is. So you've had solid ratings with average of double B for many of these countries. There's some countries like Botswana where it's actually single A rating, and Morocco as well. So, but what you've really had more than anything else is as well is that there's actually been an increasing stronger institutional framework in many of these countries. The issue of austerity has become much more interesting in the Western world in 2008, 2009. However, in Africa, particularly for the past 5-10 years, what you've seen is a significant discipline in terms of the fiscal policy. You've seen central bank policy actually become much more significantly aggressive in terms of targeting inflation. Debt to GDP levels in Africa have gone down from historically about roughly around 50% of debt to GDP to now close to 20%. Nigeria, for example, debt to GDP level is roughly around 25%. But if you look at external debt to GDP level, it's roughly around 3%. So you're looking at a very strong fiscal balances in these countries as well. Account deficits have come down significantly as well.
So once the fund is operational, what do you anticipate? And obviously this isn't set in stone and no one is going to hold you to it exactly, but what sort of weightings do you anticipate the fund might start off with once it's been invested?
Well, actually, you know, I mean, the important thing with the African market is that out of the 400 billion of issuance, you're talking about 20 African countries, really. So to really fully capture the opportunities, it's absolutely imperative to have a diversification as well. And what we're looking to do is target the top 8 most liquid markets in Africa as well. And the weighting is going to be fairly spread out. The reason for that is two reasons. One, Africa, as you're very well aware, cannot be looked at from a monolithical perspective. No. Individually, African economies have different demographics, different economic trend points as well. And we really want to be able to capture the upside in many of that as well. The second thing, which I think is absolutely critical, is that from a currency perspective, which has been the greatest concern in terms of the volatility of African currencies, what we've seen is that actually if you have a much more diversified portfolio of African countries, roughly around 10 to 15% on a portfolio weighting basis, you actually naturally hedge out some of the volatility because the correlation levels among African currencies on average has been roughly around 6%. So it's significantly lower. So you have lower intermarket correlation levels as well. So to answer your question, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so essentially, although the individual currencies are volatile because they don't move in the same direction, having a basket of them reduces the overall volatility.
Yeah, absolutely. African currencies have been less correlated to the risk-on-risk-off cycles that have characterized many of the emerging currencies and broader global markets. On rare occasions, actually, Graham, maybe 2008, where the increased correlation levels have actually happened. But historically, and we've charted this going back 20 years, African currencies have actually relatively had a very low correlation intermarket. So having a diversified portfolio of about 8 to 10 countries as well on a very relatively equal weighting basis actually significantly serves as a natural hedge, but more importantly captures many of the upsides that we've considered.
So just very briefly, those eight African countries, I presume, would include Nigeria and South Africa, but what are some of the other ones as well?
Yes, absolutely. So Nigeria and South Africa are obviously the most well-known economies with that as well. But we actually look at, in terms of Africa, we look at it from a Pan-Africa perspective. So that would also include Egypt, that would include Morocco, that will include Kenya, Ghana, Botswana, and obviously Mauritius as well, where we think where our partner Brema is based.
Great. Okay, well, that's a very interesting overview of African debt, or very good reasons for wanting to get exposure to this asset class. Good luck with the launch of the fund, because obviously it's going to be an area where you do actually get a real return after inflation. And as you said, both interest rates and volatility has come down a lot. We'll check back with you to see how it's doing in the not too distant future.
Absolutely. Africa is open for business, so we're happy for, looking forward to that. Thank you.
Thanks. Our thanks to Malik Badji of Silk Invest Funds on the line from London about the new African Emerging Africa Bond Fund, which they're launching with Brema Investment Management beginning of next month. When I come back for the break, we'll be finishing up by looking at what's happening in Nigeria with our African correspondent Samuel Okoja on the line from Lagos. So please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
The way we do banking today continues to evolve. No longer is it just brick-and-mortar locations or traditional banker's hours. Today, banking is 24/7. It's in the home. It's on the go. It's digital. Tune in to Breaking Banks with Brett King for a look at how traditional banking as we know it has changed due to a loss of trust, changing economic conditions and consumer behavior, government involvement, and, of course, technology. What does it all mean? Listen every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Earlier in the program, we were talking about the continuing crisis in Russia and Ukraine and the impact on the equity markets, which have been pretty severe. Russian markets off 15 to 20%. Not all crises, political crises, violence, terrorism, or the like, however serious and heartrending on a personal level, necessarily have that much of an impact on markets. The current kidnapping drama in Nigeria is one such case. As I said at the beginning of the show, you've no doubt seen the coverage of the tragic kidnappings of over 200 girls there in the northern state of Borno by the Islamic radical group Boko Haram. We talked a little bit about this last week with our Africa correspondent, Samuel Okoja, who's based in Lagos, and delighted to have him back this week as the situation has continued to develop to bring us up to date. Welcome back, Samuel.
Thank you so very much, Gavin. It's great to be here once again.
So could you update our listeners on the status of the attempts to free the schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram? Because I understand the Nigerian authorities have been saying they will not exchange Boko Haram prisoners for any of the kidnapped girls.
Yes, that's true. The situation right now is that we have international forces who are coming in to help the Nigerian security team to find the best possible way to handle this situation and ensure that these girls are released. So for now, what the sense I get is that this security team from the international community are trying to fine-tune strategies to ensure that these girls are released. So for now, it's a little bit too early to explain in detail the actions that have been taken. What I can say for now is that plans are being made to fashion out the best strategy to ensure these girls are out. The good thing, however, is that the girls appear to be safe. Recently, we saw a video showing the girls, and that, again, is an indication that there is still hope to ensure the girls are freed.
No, that's a very important point, obviously, and it's interesting that the introduction of Western forces, as you mentioned, is helping to maybe move this closer to resolution. Just very briefly for our listeners, Boko Haram, how long has it been going for? Because this is just the latest in a series of moves it's made, but it's quite a long established radical organization, isn't it?
Absolutely. Boko Haram is an extremist Islamic sect, you know, and they started waging war against the government about 5 years ago. They want an Islamic state in Nigeria, and they're against Western education, especially the education of girls. They feel girls should get married and not go to school, you know, and so that's what they are fighting for as it is. They've been attacking government institutions, police stations, government buildings, schools, churches, and even Muslim clerics who are against their version of Islam. So it's an extremist group, and they've been very, very violent of late.
Indeed. But despite the continuing violence and the kidnapping drama, it seems that foreign investors are actually relatively optimistic about the outlook for Nigeria. The crisis doesn't seem to have had any direct effect on the stock market or indeed the flows of direct investment into Nigeria. Is that correct, Samuel?
Absolutely, Gavin. Foreign investors remain unmoved by the seeming insecurity in Nigeria. And that's because the Nigeria government, for example, blamed on Boko Haram militants, remain confined mainly to the north, especially in the northeast of the country. If this were to spread to the south, where we have Nigeria's oil infrastructure, for example, that's when you start to have some kind of potential impact on investor sentiment. And so for now, in as much as the violence appears restricted to the section in the north, investors are unfazed. Also, Nigeria is also seeing a growing middle class that's becoming very attractive to foreign investors. For example, companies such as Procter and Gamble and MTN Group have invested in the country to tap opportunities in Africa's biggest economy, which the Nigerian government has said will expand by 6.75% this year. And according to Nigeria's Statistics Office, foreign direct investment rose 28% to $21.3 billion last year. And so what this means is that investors remain confident in the country in terms of investment opportunities.
So just finishing up here, Samuel, you attended the World Economic Forum for Africa, which we discussed briefly last week. What trends for Africa as a whole and Nigeria did you observe attending it in Abuja?
Okay, interestingly, the high turnout at WEFA, which was hosted in Abuja, has been described as one of the most successful in the history of the World Economic Forum. And that's a testament of increasing investment interest in Nigeria and not just Nigeria, but other parts of Africa. WEFA 2014 reportedly pulled about $68 billion during the three-day event for investment in healthcare, agriculture, energy, infrastructure, and other sectors of the African economy. And so the trend is that there is an increasing interest from investors in Nigeria and Africa.
I think that's a very good note to finish on, and a reminder to our listeners that regardless of what's in the headlines and however heartrending it may be on a personal level, it's nonetheless important to look at the bigger picture when considering where to invest your money and what's happening in countries. Thanks very much indeed, Samuel, and we'll be back to talk to you again about further developments, but maybe both on the Boko Haram front, but particularly as far as the economy in Nigeria and the rest of Africa is concerned.
Thanks for having me, Gavin.
Not at all. Our thanks to our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, on the line from Lagos in Nigeria. So today we've covered the emerging markets in general, the Russia-Ukraine crisis, United Arab Emirates and the effect on it of a possible slowdown in China, the African bond market and its emerging future, and what's happening in Nigeria. Next week, I'll be back with our global roster of contributors for another series of reports on emerging and frontier markets investing. I am Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Ennard. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, now available in English-speaking markets around the world from Wiley & Co., and also Frontier Markets for Dummies, which also covers the topic of frontier markets and emerging markets as a suitable place to invest. We're the publishers of the EFMI newsletter that I've been talking about during the program, and this radio program, our books, and the newsletter mean we feel we're one of the leading sources of information for you about emerging and frontier markets investing. For information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks. Please join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.